My name is Jerry Aker, and I've entitled this session, Background on Central America. The series that we're into is toward understanding Central America. And last night we talked a lot about awareness, and our own awareness, and how consciousness raising has been happening within the Central American region, within the Central American people. And I think we got into some good discussion. One of the things that we realized and we recognized last night was that certainly there's a possibility that many of you or some of you are already sort of oversaturated with information on Central America. It's such a current issue. It's a very important issue, and it's a confusing one. One of the questions that came up was, how do you decipher and discern the truth amongst all of the information that keeps coming at us? Well, I think it's important to take an historical look at Central America and at our relationships as a people and as governments and countries. And I would particularly also like to take a look at the history of the church in Central America, Latin America, as it fits into the context of the historical process going on there. It seems to many Americans that Central America burst upon our consciousness in about 1979, when all of a sudden there was turmoil and revolution going on and culminating in the triumph of that revolution in Nicaragua. And since then, we've been hearing a lot in the press at various times. I was going into El Salvador one time, and I talked to an ABC film crew, and I said, "What are you fellas doing here?" And he said, "Well, we're just having to come in here now because they're starting to talk about it more in Washington." There's a direct relationship between starting to talk about issues in Washington and where the news gets generated out wherever it is in the world. He said that, I can't remember exactly when this was, but at this time there's only about 30 or 40 foreign journalists in El Salvador. But at the time of the elections 2 months ago, there were 850 international journalists in El Salvador. Just a flood of information comes at us sometimes, and at other times, and I think, I don't know if you've noticed in your papers, in my local paper, it hasn't been much about Central America at all for a couple of months. It was very heavy a month or so ago, when the big debate was happening with regard to the Contra assistance. I'd like to maybe be a little bit participatory here in putting out an option. I do have a film strip that has been done by the Presbyterian Church. It's called Born of the People. It does a good job of pulling together background information on each of the countries. And I'd leave that as an option to show. It'll take about 18 minutes of our time. I don't want to use an audiovisual as a crutch if we get into discussion or if there's other issues that you'd like to talk about. And but it is a pretty concise way. If you feel that getting background information and a presentation of that sort would be helpful.
Sometimes I have the feeling that some reporters are very biased. If they are kind of against something, they slant their, rather than report the news as they see it, they've reported that they would like to see people.
Well, the question is with regard to the news reports and the reporters, the journalists that are reporting on Central America. His observation is that it seems to be biased in some cases.
Not all of them. Very much so.
My observation is that, having lived through two eras of sort of crisis that I've been intimately involved in, one being the Vietnam War years, when I was in Vietnam with Lutheran World Relief as well in 66, 68, and in this current crisis that we're living through, my personal feeling is that the press corps has been doing a better job in the beginning and trying to dig into the causes and the problem than they did in the beginning of the Vietnam War time. On the other hand, there certainly is a left and a liberal and a conservative bias in the press, so I wouldn't be able to interpret that any better than those of you who have been reading the press in your various cities, I guess. One of the, speaking of the Vietnam War, I read an interesting quote here. How much do we learn from history? And there's an article in here, in this book, The Central American Crisis, about the kind of comparisons between Vietnam and El Salvador and how we use history. This particular historian makes a comment that we should never again, what do we learn from Vietnam? Never again take on the job of trying to defeat a nationalist anti-colonial movement under indigenous communist control in former French Indochina. Well, that's not a lesson of very universal relevance, obviously. I think his point here was that you learn from history, but you aren't able to transfer every particular lesson because each situation is different. And certainly El Salvador and Nicaragua are vastly different than Nicaragua in a number of ways, and we could talk about that. The old proverb, I'm not sure if it's an old proverb, that says that if we don't change our direction, we're likely to end up where we're going. It may be, I'm not sure if that's an old Chinese proverb or what, but I heard it recently. I thought it was interesting. We are heading on a path in our relationship to Central America, and the Central American nations are on a path that doesn't have very much light at the end of the tunnel at the present time. Prognosis, personal prognosis, and people that I talk to who keep in touch with it aren't reporting very many positive signs as to the kind of solution and resolution of the conflict situations. But what is behind all of this turmoil and revolutionary fervor that's going on in Central America? I'd like to just sort of give some broad strokes, particularly of the church history in Latin America and in Central America. There are several sort of points that we can look back to. You're all probably pretty familiar with the colonial history, or at least vaguely familiar, that there were a couple of hundred years of colonial history in which the sword and the cross were very intimately tied, that the landed elites were benefited by the political system that was set up, and that the church fit very well into that. The church, however, did have a role, a fairly paternalistic role during those years in which they did defend, in certain cases, the rights or the life-threatening situations of Indian populations in some cases, for instance. But on the whole, the church was rather a fixed, kind of a dogmatic institution that didn't see itself as a changing institution within the context of the historical process. Its role was to hand down the dogma from one generation to the next. It had a very strong position, and that only started changing with changes that came about in the 20th century. And the changes in the 20th century have accelerated greatly in the last 20 years. We can sort of point back to the Vatican II, Pope John the 23rd, instituting great changes in the Catholic Church, which affected primarily Europe and North America in terms of structural change or theological approaches and liturgical approaches in those areas. It didn't affect until the application came beginning in the late 60s, and the historical milepost in Latin American church history in the last couple of decades or in the century comes at Medellin, called Salem II. Salem is the conference of the Episcopal Conference. It's the bishops of Latin America that met in Medellin, Colombia in 1968. That is sort of pointed to as the time when the bishops and the church as a whole took a look at what was the meaning of Vatican II for Latin America. It began a process then of the church, and that meant in many cases the priests, the nuns, and the laity being identified and living and accompanying the poor for the first time and standing on the side. The catchphrases are taking the preferential option for the poor. Participation became very important. Lay leadership and the beginning of training of catechists and so forth, and what are known as the base Christian communities. Base Christian communities meaning groups in a very localized setting of Christians that were often led by priests who lived with the poor, or by catechists themselves that were trained by priests or ordained people. That had a significant role in, I think, in this historical process which has led up to political and social change in Central America. The Protestant or evangelical churches entered later in the scene, and primarily we don't have a lot of mainline denomination presence in Central America, with the exception of a little bit over 100 years ago, the entry of the Presbyterian Church in Guatemala. The Methodist, the American Baptist Convention is fairly strong in Nicaragua. The Methodists have a small church in Costa Rica, but not much of anything in size. And the Lutherans, through the Missouri Synod, have had missionary work in Guatemala and have spread slightly into several other countries. We can talk a lot more about the significance. Well, I should mention the Moravian Church also, which has a very long history, over about 150 years, coming out of Europe into the east coast of Nicaragua. And so the Miskito population on the east coast of Nicaragua is mostly Moravian. The well, are there any questions that would be of interest to you to discuss before I show the film strip? And that'll take about 18 minutes, then we can have some questions and discussion. Well, I'm going to go up.
Stretching east and south from Mexico, Central America is a mountainous region linking the continents of the Western Hemisphere. Nature has made it turbulent. Earthquakes and volcanic eruptions often devastate the cities and the countryside. Torrential rains cause flooding, and hurricane-force winds destroy crops and homes. More than 21 million people live in this region, where most of the land is unsuitable for food production. Though seven countries lie between Mexico and Colombia, two of these, Belize and Panama, are not usually included in discussions of Central America. The others, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica, share a complex history.
More than 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, civilizations were thriving in Central America. The Olmecs and later the Mayans created art and religious customs shaped by their views of the universe. In the 1500s, the Spanish conquistadors came ashore to claim the land for Queen Isabella. The Central Americans were shocked when the Spaniards began to force a new religion, a new agriculture, and a new political structure on their lives. The well-armed Spanish killed many of the Indians and made slaves of others. Epidemics of smallpox, measles, and typhus ravaged the tribes who had no immunity to these European diseases. The Spanish forced the Indians to work on large plantations to produce crops for export to Europe. Even the Roman Catholic Church participated in the repression of the people, though many clergy showed deep concern through teaching and healing and by sharing seeds of European fruits and vegetables. With few Spanish women in the colonies, the populations intermingled, creating the people called mestizo, who now populate Central America.
Spain turned its attention from Central America in the 1820s to fight Napoleon in Europe. The former provinces created a Central American republic loosely based on the U.S. system. In response to this new political climate, the United States announced its intention to keep Europe out of the Western Hemisphere and to further its own commercial interests in the region. This policy was expressed in a speech by President Monroe in 1823 and has come to be known as the Monroe Doctrine. After 13 years, the dream of the Central American Republic dissolved and individual nations were formed. The colonial pattern of rule by a few wealthy landowners continued to dominate the economies of the new nations. The landowners banded together with military commanders, government officials, and in some cases the Catholic hierarchy to form oligarchies, that is, governments controlled by a few.
The planning of the Panama Canal in the 1880s created new interest in Central American business opportunities. U.S.-based companies wrote contracts with Central American governments to create jobs in exchange for land rights and tax exemptions. The companies could maximize their profits by raising coffee and bananas on vast plantations to sell in the United States. So small farmers were bought out or pushed off the land where they raised the maize, beans, and squash needed by the local people. During this century, the wealthy of Central America have made their way into the international elite. They travel in Europe, send their children to West Point and Ivy League schools, and enjoy the best life money can buy. A growing middle class of teachers, doctors, engineers, and owners of small businesses has begun to play a larger role in national life. The poor remain poor. With no power, no money, no opportunities, and no resources, their frustrations grow.
Although traditionally the Roman Catholic Church has been socially conservative, it has played a major role in challenging political and economic oppression in Central America. When the Second Vatican Council met from 1962 to 1965, it committed the Catholic Church to an active role in the promotion of justice, human rights, and freedom. In 1968, Roman Catholic bishops of Latin America met in Medellin, Colombia, and committed themselves to the defense of the poor, asserting that the gospel requires the church to identify itself with the poor and the oppressed. The theology of liberation. The church throughout Central America began a new type of grassroots pastoral work called Comunidades de Baza, base Christian communities involving lay leadership, Bible study, social and economic discussion, and participation in the sacraments. Through this church program, the people at the bottom are beginning to see that God gives them rights and dignity. Scripture is their light for understanding the reality of their poverty and oppression.
Three concerns have motivated United States policies in Central America in the 20th century. The first is the determination to protect U.S. interests, including the Panama Canal, and the U.S.-owned businesses which profit from the sale of Central American coffee, bananas, and other products to the U.S. and Europe. The second concern is a determination to keep socialism and communism out of Central America. The third concern is the desire to see human rights respected throughout the region. The first two concerns, the protection of our interests and the combating of socialism and communism, reinforce each other. Yet the third concern, the concern for human rights, includes the right of people to choose their own form of government. And the United States has found it hard to believe that a nation might freely choose a socialist or communist government. So we have repeatedly intervened, openly or secretly, to block what we call communist subversion. By such intervention, the United States has frequently propped up military dictatorships who cooperate with U.S. businesses and wealthy Central American landowners to exploit the poor.
Nowhere is the story clearer than in Guatemala. In the 1940s, after decades of collaboration between the Guatemalan military government and the U.S.-based United Fruit Company, a people's movement toward democracy and social justice brought about the first free election in Guatemalan history. The new government began to struggle against the domination of the economy by United Fruit, who owned most of the railroads, paid no taxes to Guatemala, and worked with the local landowners to keep wages low. United Fruit's response was to convince U.S. leaders, including John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, that the elected Guatemalan leaders were Soviet puppets. So in 1954, the CIA organized and led an invasion of Guatemala to install a CIA-chosen president. Ever since then, the Guatemalan military government has repressed the people, especially the Indians, who make up more than half of the population of 7 million. Thousands of Guatemalans have been tortured and killed by government forces. The Catholic bishops estimate that 1 million persons have been uprooted, many of them fleeing into Mexico, the United States, and other neighboring countries. General replaces general as head of the government, but Guatemala's problems remain unchanged. The Indian communities are broken up and relocated, and their members starved into submission. Secret committees of the government execute people without trials. The military government uses brutal tactics against the leaders of schools, churches, cooperatives, and labor groups, claiming to suspect them of insurgency.
El Salvador is the smallest, most crowded nation in Central America, with 5 million people in a mountainous country the size of Massachusetts. The struggle between the government, led by the military, and the campesinos, as the peasants are called, has been almost continuous. Right-wing death squads acting for the military under the name Orden have murdered many people, and at the opposite extreme, guerrilla groups acting on behalf of the campesinos have kidnapped and sometimes killed members of the ruling class. Local small gatherings of Christians have quietly been learning from the Bible to think and act for themselves. This sharing of resources and concerns among the laity has forged a solid base of people who are determined to work for a better El Salvador. The military has struck out at anyone perceived as the opposition. Consequently, the Christian community has borne the brunt of the government retaliation. Though many thousands of Christians have died in the conflict, the murder of Salvadoran Archbishop Romero and the slaughter of 4 U.S. Catholic women workers riveted the attention of the U.S. on El Salvador. In addition, thousands of Salvadorans have fled to the United States seeking asylum from the terror in El Salvador, only to be turned away by the United States government. Meanwhile, the unrest grows. Wealthy Salvadorans have spirited more than $1 billion out of El Salvador, while the United States sends in increased financial aid and more military advisors.
Honduras, 80% mountainous, is the least developed, poorest country in Central America. Its 4 million people have the lowest incomes and the highest illiteracy. Most of the people scratch out a living on small plots on the hillsides. Social and health services are meager. Honduras has been a rather peaceful country in spite of its border disputes with land-hungry El Salvador. Recently, the Honduran economy, based on the export of coffee, bananas, pineapples, and timber, and subsidized by international loans, has begun to collapse. In 1981, Hondurans elected a civilian government for the first time in a decade, giving it a mandate to turn things around. But about the same time, the United States chose Honduras as its base for Central American military operations. That action has turned the Honduran Democratic government into a facade for a new military dictatorship. The U.S. has built a large training camp for Salvadoran soldiers on the Caribbean coast of Honduras, and it conducts U.S. military exercises in and around the country. Honduras has by far the strongest air force in the region, and the U.S. is building new airfields in strategic places in the highlands.
Nicaragua has the largest land area and one of the smallest populations in Central America. It has more good crop soil than any of its neighbors. The United States controlled events in Nicaragua from 1911 until 1979. In order to protect the interests of U.S. mining and fruit companies, President Taft sent the U.S. Marines to Nicaragua in 1911. By the late 20s, a grassroots resistance to the U.S. presence developed, led by Augusto Cesar Sandino. Sandino was committed to improving the plight of the poor in Nicaragua and was determined to free Nicaragua from U.S. imperialism. President Roosevelt brought the Marines home in 1933, but left the government of Nicaragua in the hands of Anastasio Somoza, a general chosen by the Marines and under the control of the U.S. government. Sandino led a fight against Somoza's oppressive rule of the Nicaraguan people, but in 1934, he was murdered by Somoza's men. Through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, Somoza and his sons continued their dynasty as the protectors of U.S. interests in Nicaragua. In the early 70s, outrage at the Somoza family's brutal tactics developed into a broad-based resistance movement called Sandinism, revitalizing Sandino's hopes for the people of Nicaragua. After a bloody revolution, Somoza's government finally toppled. When the day of Sandinista victory came, July 19, 1979, the country erupted in a celebration of joy and hope. An awesome task faced the new government. Somoza and his friends had emptied the national treasury by taking $1.5 billion out of the country. Nicaragua was left with 100,000 wounded people, property damage of $500 million, and a national debt of $3.5 billion, which the new government is struggling to honor. Land ownership reform, health care, and national reconstruction have received top priority, and the Sandinista government has encouraged international organizations to come in and check for human rights violations. Sandinism has been deeply shaped by Christian values through the leadership of clergy and laity, and at the same time, it has drawn upon Marxist thinking in its social analysis of Nicaraguan history. This combination of Christian and Marxist reflection has led to a determination to establish a society that is dedicated to social justice for all. The literate middle class has given substantial support to the Sandinistas. Having been counseled by the Cubans that state-run economies are difficult to manage, the Sandinistas encouraged private enterprise in an attempt to establish a mixed economy that is both planned and efficient. Today, 75% of economic production is in the hands of the private enterprise group. Literacy was an immediate goal. Within the first year, 60,000 students left the cities to live with families in the countryside to teach everyone to read. In 8 months, illiteracy was reduced from 68% to 12%. Cuba and many Western European governments helped with the social programs. But not all has gone well or easily for the Sandinista government. Private investors have been very cautious. The national debt has weighed heavily. Some Catholic bishops have been critical of what they regard as the trend to Marxist socialism. In the Sandinista debates over policy, factions have arisen and some leaders have broken away. And the United States has consistently opposed the Sandinista government. We have cut off wheat loans, announced contingency plans for invasion, blocked loans from international agencies, and have virtually shut off Nicaragua's sugar sales to our country. The CIA has organized and funded former soldiers of Somoza, who are stationed in Honduras. These soldiers, called Somozistas, along with other anti-Sandinista groups, have mounted attacks on Nicaragua. But despite the problems, in July 1983, on the fourth anniversary of the new regime, enthusiastic crowds of Nicaraguans pledged their support to the government and to the nation. And on that same day, our House of Representatives in Washington met in secret session and debated whether the United States should continue our undercover actions to overthrow the government of Nicaragua.
Costa Rica, a gentle upland country, contrasts sharply with the rest of Central America. It is a middle-class society with firmly established democratic patterns, elections every 4 years, a free and active press, a 90% literacy rate, and well-established courts of law. Costa Rica has no army. Medium-sized family farms produce the crops that form the economic base of Costa Rica: cocoa, coffee, bananas, sugar, and milk. With a per capita income double that of its neighbors, the people have been comparatively well-fed, well-housed, and well-provided with medical care. The extremes of wealth and poverty are not as blatant as in other parts of Central America. Education gets the largest share of the national budget. It is free to all students and compulsory through high school. And yet, despite its good fortune, Costa Rica faces increasing problems. The price of imported oil is high, and the price of exported coffee is low. These factors, when combined with inflation, have led to trade deficits and foreign indebtedness. Unemployment, hunger, and malnutrition are increasing. And although Costa Rica has long pursued a middle course between socialism and capitalism, there are indications now that the government is moving toward the right. Costa Rica is affected by the rapid changes taking place throughout Central America. Its police force, which has been trusted and respected by the people, is now being armed with heavy military weapons. Costa Ricans, formerly optimistic about the future, are growing uneasy.
In recent years, as U.S. support of military regimes in Guatemala and El Salvador has increased, the number of people killed or uprooted from their communities has also increased. Many have sought refuge and asylum in neighboring countries, and a continual stream have made their way to the United States. Some 500,000 Salvadorans and Guatemalans since 1979. But our immigration officials cannot admit that these refugees are fleeing political persecution because the U.S. supports the governments of these countries. Therefore, since 1980, the U.S. government has captured and returned more than 35,000 people to El Salvador alone, although it is known that many of them have been tortured and killed upon arrival in their homeland. Some congregations in the United States, disturbed by U.S. policies which turn Central Americans into asylum seekers and then turn them away, have declared that their church buildings are sanctuaries for the refugees, a new underground railroad to freedom.
The Bible is being read in a new way and with a fresh vision. The old political and economic structures are being threatened by a new theological vision of the kingdom of God. The church has nourished among the poor the hope of the gospel, that God intends for all to have life and to have it abundantly, not only in the spiritual sense, but in the fullness of life in its many dimensions. A new reformation has begun in Central America. It is at the heart of the political and social turmoil in that region. The new reformation is truly ecumenical, facing Protestant, Catholic, Pentecostal, liberal, and conservative, with a new phenomenon, la iglesia que nace del pueblo, the church that is born from the people. The assembly petitions the United States, Cuban, Soviet, Israeli, and other governments to work toward negotiated rather than military solutions to regional conflicts, to end governmental military aid to Central America, to eliminate immediately the traffic of arms into and within Central America, and to cease all covert and overt activities aimed at destabilizing governments in Central America.
A new consensus is arising among American churches to work for change in our national policy toward Central America. Every mainline U.S. denomination is on record as opposed to those policies. Positive actions are being taken. In July 1983, Roman Catholic Bishop McGann asked Roman Catholics on Long Island to lobby for an end to military aid to El Salvador and to grant temporary asylum to the 40,000 Salvadorans now in that diocese. So now, a great drama is to be played out within our shores. The churches in the U.S., out of love for neighbor and in solidarity with the suffering and liberating churches in Central America, have set themselves to the awesome task of changing the policies of our nation, which oppress the people of Central America. It is a time which calls for Christian commitment to stand with the poor in their struggle for peace with justice.
Very massive indictment of U.S. policy, she says. Well, this film strip certainly is. Do you think it's a slanted point of view? How does it come across to you? Is credible?
Bent on including things. It's probably the closest fully democratic church I've been involved in. And they put out both the majority and minority report. Not getting any comment of minority report out of this, or any comment, would tend to say they were pretty well in agreement.
Well, we've had know that the United States government sent in to protect the wealthy United States investors over there, regardless of who got hurt over there. We know that for a fact before all this unrest even started.
Has the U.S. government done anything right?
Well, it sounds like a facetious question, but it's a serious one. And I think it's one that we should seriously consider, because we don't want to take an unfair or slanted view also of our government and its positions. That's a political question also. In looking at, in my impression of talking to just a lot of people in Latin America and reading a lot about Latin America, my impression is that there are several periods in this history, in this century particularly, when Latin Americans look very favorably upon the United States leadership and its administration. One person who is a hero in Latin America is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I think. Of course, that was a time of great world turmoil, and Latin America wasn't involved in the same way in relationships. Was that called the good neighbor policy, wasn't it, of Roosevelt? Also, Kennedy is a popular figure. You see plazas and streets and so forth named after Kennedy. Kennedy initiated the Alliance for Progress, which, as historians now analyze it, had questionable results. I think also Carter's human rights policy was well respected by many Latin Americans, and was seen as a very decent man. I know personally a number of people who feel that they're alive today because of that policy, particularly Chileans and Argentinians. I think Esquivel has commented positively about that. Some of the others of you might have comments on this question. Has the United States done anything right? Because it looks like such a strong indictment about the way we relate to our neighbors. You know, the strong democratic values that we have is, you know, what are our interests in Central America? Human rights and democracy is certainly an interest of ours. And if that doesn't get sort of overplayed, over-dominated by the other forces of more powerful people that have control politically and economically, then I think there's a possibility that we can be make a good impact. And I never found in my years of traveling in many countries in Latin America any personal animosity toward me as an American. I think Latin Americans generally feel good and want to be in good relationship with Americans. Hans lived in Latin America for 20 years, so in a different region that I don't know very well, Brazil. Maybe you could comment on that if you want to. It's a different story for sure. There's a wide variety of reactions to Cuba and to this word communism in Central America and amongst the people there, as there is in our country, I think. I find in Honduras, an uptightness about that whole issue, about Cuba, about communism and so forth. In Nicaragua, obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of exchange of people between Cuba and Nicaragua since 79. I know many evangelical pastors now that have gone and visited Cuba and vice versa. The Cubans are coming to Nicaragua. And so with that kind of people-to-people relationship, you don't find a fear of Cuba within Nicaragua. But in the other countries, which are much more anti-communist, in quotes, you would find a fear of the unknown. I don't know that Castro was looked at in the way that you're asking about, as a kind of a model, as a counterbalance. He is certainly by a certain sector within Latin America. But when he recently called the conference, which he called for all Latin American, he called leadership and others from all Latin America to make a stand, a united stand against this tremendous debt crisis that's afflicting Latin America. By and large, the top leadership in the Latin American countries didn't go to his conference, mostly academics and others, other kind of leaders that went to that, and they made a lot of speeches about it, but it wasn't, my reading is that it wasn't taken as seriously as maybe Castro. So that might be a little indication that when it comes to leadership for Latin America and how they're going to deal with this, on the one side, revolutionary and violent social change, and the other side, the structural debt crisis, I think the Latin Americans are looking for another kind of leadership.
Is there any way they can get some of this money back that the leader ran off with?
No.
Did the leader just take it and put it in your own pocket?
Well, you're talking about Somoza, the reference to Somoza. Somoza's long gone, and I don't think there's any way you can get it out of the Swiss bank accounts once it's in there. I think the American role is key. I mean, it's very essential that there is going to be some kind of American role in terms of Central America, and I think maybe you could generalize to Latin America. There is an interdependence. No Central American country can be completely independent because they don't have the manufacturing, they don't have the industrial base, and so forth. There has to be trade. There has to be investment and this kind of thing, and aid.
Excuse me,
military. Military. Well, that's another question, I'm sorry. The military intervention you're talking about and the kind of protection role that the United States plays in Central America. The proposal of the Contadora group, which I think is a very sound one and the only viable option that I see, if you're familiar with Contadora, which is the four other larger countries, Venezuela, Mexico, Panama. What's the other one? Anyway, the Contadora group that is trying to mediate a peaceful solution is the withdrawal of foreign military advisors. That would mean then the American advisors from Honduras and El Salvador. It would mean Cuban advisors from Nicaragua. If they could arrive at that, I think it would be great. It would be tremendous. I don't think they're going to come to that ideal solution. So, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of negotiating, and there isn't much negotiating going on right now. What would happen? El Salvador, the government of El Salvador would fall. They're very much into a kind of a situation like the dynamics of the Vietnam War. The El Salvador government is something like 70 or 80% dependent now on U.S. aid for propping up their economy as well as their military operation and fighting the war. Honduras is increasingly dependent, and we are trying to get Costa Rica to become more dependent on us. So we have sent in recently and tried to train militarily their civil guard. As noted in the film, there is no army in Costa Rica. Guatemala is, interestingly enough, even though it's a repressive, has a history since 1954 as a very oppressive government, a military government, has maintained a neutrality, and they would probably be affected the least. When Carter said, no military assistance until you clean up your Human Rights Act, they said, fine, we don't need it. And so they've been doing it on their own. They've been doing their repression, I think, basically without us. So, right. Well, any other comments? I don't want to just respond to questions, but to have your comments.
This is probably not a great subject to bring up, but we got as far as Carter. The current administration takes a lot of licks, but one comment that came out not so long ago, I'm not sure just how long ago, but in reaction to the policy of constructive engagement in South Africa, some administration official pointed to Latin America in general. said, well, look at these new democratic elections we've had and our policies here have worked. Do you really think, is that the current administration taking credit, or is that leftovers from Carter, or is that just random occurrence?
Well, if you look at Latin America as a whole, it's a different scene than if you look at Central America. There have been some very positive things on democratization in Latin America in the last 2 years or so. The election in Brazil, the election in Uruguay, and in Argentina. Chile is still a long way off. In Peru, a very positive election just a month ago. And so the democratization, the freeing of the people through that process, the freeing of from that tremendous oppression that was going on during the dirty war in Argentina and so forth, is a positive trend in more in South America than in Central America. But they would include also El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, who are in election processes also. At least the administration would interpret that as democracy in action. Okay, well, tomorrow I want to look at Guatemala more specifically. I do want to try to look for the positives, and I'm glad you brought up that question, because I don't want to end up every session everybody going out of here on a downer, you know, because it can end up that way. I find when you start talking about Central America, it looks like a kind of a quagmire, and maybe it is, but I think as Christian people we have to be looking for our role and for viable solutions and participation. Thank you very much.